Section 4.5. Understanding Abstract Power. Those who tell the stories rule society. Plato. So far, the author has outlined 8 of 10 applications of abstract thinking which behaviorally modern sapiens have evolved since the Upper Paleolithic era. The reader has learned about how sapient neocortices help sapiens with pattern finding, exercising caution, symbolism, planning, strategizing, higher order communication using semantically and syntactically complex languages, storytelling, solving physically unverifiable mysteries, and developing abstract constructs and belief systems like morals, ethics, and theologies. These last two applications of abstract thought are so important to the topic of power projection tactics employed by humans in modern agrarian society that they each get their own dedicated section. 9. Creating abstract power, and 10. Encoding abstract power hierarchies. As a quick disclaimer for the reader, these sections represent an inflection point where the concepts become political sounding. This is due to the subject matter. A discussion about how abstract power is created, how abstract power hierarchies function, and how abstract power hierarchies become dysfunctional to the point of motivating people to fight and kill each other in massive scale physical power competitions, in other words, wars, is fundamentally a discussion about politics. Moreover, a discussion about why humans fight and kill each other is an emotionally charged topic. There are few things more personal than the motives behind why a person would be compelled to take the life of another. But to understand the complex social implications of Bitcoin and to develop a common understanding of how Bitcoin could represent a soft form of warfare that could mitigate fratricide, it is necessary to investigate them. Section 4.5.1. To avoid physical confrontations, sapiens dress up and play make-believe. The desire not to cause pain and suffering to other animals, except fish, shellfish, and insects, not only explains why humans started adopting abstract power belief systems to morally justify their predation of animals, it also explains why humans adopt abstract belief systems to 1. Avoid having to fight and kill each other as much as possible, and 2. Morally justify their fighting and killing when they inevitably have to do it. As a simple example of this, consider how the word defense translates to morally justified fighting and killing. As discussed in the previous chapter, animals use physical power to settle intraspecies disputes and establish dominance hierarchies over limited resources. But this can sometimes lead to fratricide. Fratricide is especially troubling for highly empathetic predators like humans, who are hyper-aware of the stress and trauma they can cause to others thanks to their big brains. One way to circumvent the discomfort of potentially injuring a fellow human to solve a property dispute or establish a pecking order is to adopt a belief system where disputes can be settled and pecking orders can be established by people who have imaginary power rather than real power. Sapient brains are so effortlessly gifted at abstract thinking, and people have such strong natural instincts not to injure each other, that people will attempt to use their imaginations to avoid having to physically confront each other to settle their disputes, manage their resources, and establish their dominance hierarchies. One of the most defining characteristics of behaviorally modern sapiens who lived after the invention of agriculture and the wide-scale domestication of animals is the adoption of common belief systems where some people wield abstract or imaginary power, and those people are allowed to settle disputes, manage resources, and determine the pecking order for the broader population, explicitly so that they don't have to fight over it like practically all other pack animals do. Modern domesticated sapiens could be described as being so averse to physical confrontation that they prefer to dress up in costumes and play make-believe to settle their disputes, manage their resources, and establish their pecking order. Then, emboldened by their ideologies, they look down upon wild animals precisely because those animals don't, or more accurately, can't, use their imaginations to settle their disputes or establish their pecking order. As previously noted, wild animals appear to be physiologically incapable of this. They didn't have the watts to think abstractly and use their imaginations because they didn't learn how to handle tinder, control fire, and cook their food to fuel their brains like humans did. Herein lies the reason why the author spent so much time walking the reader through the evolution of abstract thinking and human metacognition. Without critically examining human metacognition, it's impossible to establish a first principles understanding of how and why agrarian society has decided to adopt common belief systems where fully grown adults put on wigs and gowns and live-action role-play, LARP, like they have power in order to settle people's disputes without physical conflict. Almost everywhere one looks in modern agrarian society, sapiens are seen using symbols of power, for example, rank, rather than real power, for example, watts. They print symbols of their imaginary power on pieces of cloth and tie them up on top of flagpoles. They wear symbols of their imaginary power as lapel pins. Some even continue to dress up in wigs, gowns, and crowns, and practically all of them stand up in front of podiums etched with symbols of their imaginary power. Why do behaviorally modern humans behave in this incredibly bizarre way in comparison to other species? In what some might consider to be a comedic display of irony, society's symbols of abstract and imaginary power frequently show images of wild predators like lions, animals which become fierce precisely because they don't role-play to settle their disputes and establish their pecking order. Tying this observation back to the core concepts presented in the previous chapter about power projection tactics in nature, one of the reasons why lions are so fierce is because they mastered real power projection to build their dominance hierarchies, and they do other fierce things which domesticated societies claim is ideologically beneath them, even though they still do it too. If one were to take the perspective of a non-human outsider, such as an alien visiting Earth, the social behavior of modern domesticated agrarian sapiens might seem bizarre compared to the behavior of other animals. Sapiens behave much differently than other species in nature. They live under a mutually adopted, global-scale, consensual hallucination where very few people get to have extraordinary levels of imaginary power that most of the population doesn't get access to. And then the population chooses to allow these people with non-existent physical power to call the shots. Why would sapiens behave like this? The answer is deceptively simple: to save energy, and to attempt to reduce the risk of injury. Abstract belief systems where people have imaginary power serves as an alternative way to settle disputes, establish control authority over resources, and achieve consensus on the legitimate state of ownership and chain of custody of property in an energy-efficient way that doesn't directly cause injury. Emphasis on the word directly. In other words, abstract power is a story that people are intrinsically motivated to believe in because they like the idea of not having to spend energy or hurt each other to settle intra-species disputes or establish their pecking order. Abstract power and their corresponding dominance hierarchies, what the author calls abstract power hierarchies, represent a belief system to which many people subscribe simply because they want to believe that there are viable alternatives to physical conflict as the basis for settling intraspecies disputes and establishing intraspecies pecking order. It's a good story which motivates people to work together and cooperate at large scales. The idea that sapiens have somehow outsmarted natural selection and used their neocortices to find a viable substitute for physical confrontation to settle intraspecies disputes and establish intraspecies pecking order is an extremely attractive idea. And as we know from the concepts provided about storytelling, the more sapiens can get behind a common idea, the more they can sum their physical power together and literally move mountains. Unfortunately, abstract belief systems are fictional stories. Our beliefs about a better way to settle our intraspecies disputes and establish our intraspecies pecking order also clearly don't work as well as we wish they would work, because sapiens still routinely engage in physical confrontation to settle intraspecies disputes and establish intraspecies pecking order, the exact same way animals do. Section 4.5.2. Belief in imaginary power is an attack vector which breeds god kings.
It is not the lash they fear. It is my divine power. But I am a generous god. I can make you rich beyond all measure.
Xerxes, 300. The problem with the belief that physical confrontation can be mitigated by subscribing to a common belief system where people with abstract or imaginary power settle disputes and maintain a pecking order in a non-physical way is that this reasoning ignores important systemic factors which motivate physical confrontation. Namely, the fact that people demonstrably can't be trusted not to abuse their abstract or imaginary power. In other words, these belief systems ignore why societies eventually become compelled to engage in physical confrontations in the first place, despite their desire to avoid it. There are major downsides to the wide-scale adoption of common abstract belief systems, which are critical to investigate if we are to understand why sapiens struggle to find lasting alternatives to physical confrontation as the basis for solving intraspecies disputes and establishing intraspecies pecking order. A major problem, which will be discussed at length in this chapter, is that belief systems represent a breeding ground for systemic predators to psychologically abuse and systemically exploit entire populations of people through their belief systems. These attacks are passive-aggressive and often go without detection because they don't have a physical footprint. It is therefore necessary to call them out explicitly so we can better understand the complex trans-scientific and socio-technical implications of new technologies like Bitcoin. Storytelling introduces a psychological attack vector where sapiens can be preyed upon. The most common way this happens in agrarian society is by telling stories to convince people to adopt belief systems where a select few have abstract power. The problem is, abstract power is systemically exploitable. By convincing people to believe in abstract power, storytellers deliberately implant an exploitable vulnerability into people's imaginations, which they can take advantage of later. It's essentially a zero day for people who are familiar with common computer exploits. Once storytellers have convinced a population to adopt a belief system where imaginary power exists, storytellers create a vector through which they can exploit people
by giving themselves access to the imaginary power endogenous to the belief system. This type of predatory behavior through people's belief systems emerged early in agrarian society and has persisted for thousands of years. A simple example of these kinds of predators who systemically exploited their population's belief systems were god kings such as the pharaoh shown in figure 43. A god king exploiting a population's belief system. To better understand how vulnerable sapient belief systems are to psychological exploitation and abuse, we can use adversarial thinking to analyze how to create and codify abstract power. The reader is invited to assume you are a systemic predator who wants to psychologically exploit a human population's belief system for your own personal advantage. What is the most important thing you need the population to believe in so that you can have extraordinary amounts of imaginary power and control authority over their valuable resources? One thing you could do is convince them to believe that using physical power to establish their dominance hierarchy is morally bad. You could convince them that there are ideological alternatives to physical power for establishing control authority over their resources and achieving consensus on the legitimate state of ownership and chain of custody of their property. Perhaps the population might become concerned that you could abuse your abstract power to exploit them. If that's the case, then you could convince them that imaginary, logical constraints encoded into rules of law are fully sufficient at protecting them against systemic predators like you, who can exploit imaginary power. Once the population has been convinced that imaginary power hierarchies encoded into rules of law are incontrovertibly better than physical power, then you could simply place yourself at the top of that abstract power hierarchy by masquerading as the morally, ethically, ideologically, or theologically fit candidate for the job. If you are successful, the population will bend to your will and do your bidding for you, labor for you, kill for you, give you their most valuable resources, and worship you like a god, just like a domesticated animal would. In other words, you can domesticate a human population by getting them to adopt a belief system which convinces them that it's bad to be physically powerful or physically aggressive. Once they have adopted ideologies which cause them to forfeit their real power for your imaginary power, you essentially own them. One of the major challenges associated with using imaginary power as the basis for settling disputes and managing resources is that it's imaginary. It exists for no other reason than the fact that people are physiologically capable of thinking abstractly and adopting abstract belief systems. Because of the way our neocortices effortlessly engage in bidirectional abstract thinking and symbolic reasoning, people can, and often do, live their entire lives cognitively entrapped under these population-scale consensual hallucinations, where it's impossible for them to see how vulnerable they are to psychological abuse and exploitation through their belief systems. Tragically, this also makes them incapable of seeing how easy it would be to escape their psychological entrapment. People will legitimately believe that those who wear striped headcloths or lapel pins are actually powerful and fear their divine power over generations, birthing dynasties of oppressive god kings. Populations will labor for their god kings, kill for them, forfeit their resources to them, and even let their oppressors define what's right or good or fair. Section 4.5.3, The Cycle of Human History. Hard times create strong men. Strong men create good times. Good times create weak men, and weak men create hard times. G. Michael Hupf, Those Who Remain. Across multiple generations, entire populations of agrarian sapiens will believe that their imaginary local constraints are viable substitutes for physical power as a mechanism for imposing physical costs on attackers. They will believe that they have miraculously transcended natural selection and found a moral or ethical alternative with the same capacity for survival. Moral or ethical, according to whom? And then, once enough of the population has been convinced that they're secure against exploitation due to nothing more than the logical constraints encoded into rules of law, they self-domesticate. They become docile. They condemn physical confrontation and aggression. Instead of vectoring their resources to the most physically powerful, they socially exile them. They condemn them as warmongers. They place the people with the real power at the bottom of their pecking order, in favor of people with peaceful forms of imaginary power. The fossil record shows us what happens next. Either their own god kings exploit or slaughter them, or their neighboring god kings do. As illustrated in bowtie notation in Figure 44, a repeating cycle of human history seems to work in cycles, where societies get comfortable and complacent with their high-functioning belief systems and stop projecting physical power to increase their cost of attack. As they become increasingly more resource-abundant but increasingly less physically powerful and aggressive, their BCRA climbs. Not surprisingly, these societies get devoured by predators, just like any other organism or organization in nature would. Meanwhile, societies which employ the grow cost of attack first, then grow benefit of attack second strategy survive and become the new dominant society because they have the lowest BCRA, thus the highest prosperity margin. But this new society eventually becomes comfortable and complacent, stops increasing their cost of attack, and the cycle repeats. When human populations become too docile or domesticated, either their territory gets physically captured or their belief system gets psychologically exploited. If the former, the population gets emergency drafted, misplaced, sent to labor camps, sent to mass early graves, or, most likely, starves. If the latter, the population gets systemically exploited and oppressed at extraordinary scales through their own belief systems, leaving them entrapped and enslaved with no capacity to understand what the root cause of their oppression is. During the collapse of these complex agrarian societies, maybe a few will have the intellectual humility to think twice about their decision to condemn physical power and aggression. Maybe they will stop and consider the idea that it was a mistake to adopt belief systems which require trust in untrustworthy people to function properly, and recognize that their beliefs in imaginary power, combined with their condemnation of physical power, led them straight to the slaughter. Rather than take accountability for their decisions and question the grossly unrealistic assumptions they made when they adopted their belief systems, many will instead choose to blame their invaders or their systemic oppressors for their losses. To their graves, they will continue to LARP like they ever had the option of living in a world without predators and entropy, as if they are the only organism in the world that doesn't have an intrinsic responsibility to keep themselves physically secure against attackers. They will masquerade like peaceful alternatives to physical conflicts ever existed at any time in history except temporarily, or at any place on this planet except exclusively within their imaginations. Such is the tragedy of domesticated sapiens and their willful ignorance of power projection tactics in modern society. Section 4.5.4. Understanding the socio-technical differences between real power and imaginary power. A 10,000-year-old human fossil record shows evidence of the same pattern repeating itself over and over again, backed by an additional 5,000 years of written testimony. Bad things happen to those who forfeit their capacity and inclination to project power in favor of imaginary or abstract power. Good things happen to those who master their capacity and inclination to project physical power and impose severe physical costs on their attackers, whether the attacks come from inside or outside society. To recall a core concept from the previous chapter, we have highly randomized and variable data sets between many different agrarian societies who have tried many different experiments with many different resource management strategies. We can analyze these data ex post facto using statistical methods to find causally inferable relationships between physical power, physical aggression, and social prosperity. These causally inferable relationships can also be found in the animals we domesticate and slaughter on a regular basis. The proof is literally served to us on a silver platter. Yet somehow, sapient populations keep allowing themselves to fall into the exact same traps over and over again. Why is that? One explanation could be that because so few people in modern agrarian society devote themselves to the task of understanding and mastering physical power projection, they don't understand it. Combining this idea with the fact that most people don't think about their own metacognition, it could be the case that people are blissfully unaware of the fact that there are very clear, very measurable differences between physical power and abstract power, which explain their different emergent behavior. If that's the case, then we can explicitly call out the differences between real power and imaginary power so that people can better understand why they produce different emergent behavior. Once we understand how and why imaginary power and real power produce different emergent behavior, we can understand why abstract power hierarchies have so many dysfunctions which lead to war. Figure 45 provides a breakdown of some of the characteristics of physical power using a real example. Captain Elizabeth Eastman does a pre-flight inspection of her A-10 Thunderbolt II. This is an illustration of real power. In other words, physical power, or watts. Here, Captain Elizabeth Eastman is pictured doing a pre-flight inspection of her physical power projection technology, an A-10 Thunderbolt II Warthog. Like all physical power, Captain Eastman's power is self-evident and self-legitimizing. People can instinctively recognize and verify the presence of her physical power. It's also exogenous to people's belief systems, making it invulnerable to systemic exploitation. Physical power is unsympathetic, meaning it works the same regardless of whether people believe in it or sympathize with it. More of it can't be created out of thin air, making it thermodynamically restricted. Its execution can't be reversed, making it path-dependent. Everyone is free to access and leverage Watts the same way she can regardless of their rank, title, standing, or belief system, making it inclusive and egalitarian. Physical power is also unbounded. There's theoretically no limit to how many Watts people can use to defend themselves, particularly against her and her peers. Physical power also has a physical signature and leaves a blood trail, making it easy for people to see the threat and organize to defend against it. Table 2 provides a breakdown of these characteristics.
Table 2. Characteristics of Captain Eastman's real or physical power. System characteristics and descriptions. It is self-evident and self-legitimizing. People can instinctively recognize and respect her power based off its own merit, making it independently verifiable. It's systemically exogenous, derived from a source that is external to people's belief systems. Therefore, it's impossible to be systemically exploited. It's unsympathetic. Doesn't need people to believe in it or sympathize with her power for it to function. Functions the same for different people with different belief systems or sympathies. It's physically constrainable. In her operational domain of shared objective physical reality, there are a lot of ways to physically constrain her from using or scaling her power. It's thermodynamically restricted. More of this power can't be created out of thin air and awarded to people. If she is to have more of it, she must be intelligent and resourceful enough to master nature. It is path-dependent. The execution of her power cannot be reversed, appealed, or undone. It's inclusive and egalitarian. Everyone has access to the same type of physical power she is using and countervail her with it, regardless of their rank, title, standing, or belief system. It's unbounded. There is no limit to the amount of her type of power that people can use against her. It's attributable. Because her power has a physical signature, in other words, a blood trail, it's easy for people to see the threat of her power and organize to defend against it. It's energy intensive. Requires a great deal of physical effort for her to exercise her power, creating a natural barrier to entry. It directly leads to injury, if kinetic. People directly get hurt when she exercises or mismanages her power, making it much easier for people to see and get upset by it, giving her lower margin for error. These characteristics could be described as useful features which enable physical power to function nicely as a zero-trust, permissionless, and egalitarian basis for settling intra-species disputes, establishing control authority over intra-species resources, and achieving consensus on the legitimate state of ownership and chain of custody of intra-species property in a way that is invulnerable to systemic exploitation of people's belief systems. The downside, of course, is that projecting physical power is energy intensive and often leads to injury, if kinetic. Hence why people are often motivated to seek alternative solutions to physical power projection. If we combine all these characteristics together, we can expect a socio-technical cooperation system that uses physical power to settle disputes, manage resources, and establish pecking order to have precisely the same kind of complex emergent behavior observed in the physical power projection competitions of nature, where those who emerge as the top power projectors have survived a rigorous but objectively fair natural selection process, which separates those who are stronger, more intelligent, better organized, and more resourceful from those who are demonstrably unfit for survival. In direct contrast to real or physical power, we have abstract or imaginary power. Figure 46 provides a breakdown of the characteristics of abstract power using another real example. Chief Justice Anthony Dudley presides over the Supreme Court of Gibraltar. This is an illustration of imaginary power, in other words, abstract power or rank. Here, Chief Justice Dudley is pictured presiding over the Supreme Court of Gibraltar. Like all abstract power, Chief Justice Dudley's power is imaginary. It doesn't physically exist anywhere except exclusively within people's collective imaginations.
It's neither self-evident nor self-legitimizing, which means people can't instinctively recognize or independently verify it based off its own merit. It's also systemically endogenous to people's belief systems, making it highly vulnerable to systemic exploitation and abuse. Chief Justice Dudley's abstract power is sympathetic. It requires people to believe in it and to be sympathetic to it, or else it doesn't function. It's also physically unconstrained. There is nothing physically limiting his imaginary power from scaling globally. The only constraints to his imaginary power are imaginary logical constraints encoded into a rule set he's not required to be sympathetic to, which are endogenous to the same belief system and therefore equally as vulnerable to systemic exploitation. His abstract power is also path-independent, making it reversible. At the same time, it's thermodynamically unsound, because it can be created out of thin air. It's non-inclusive and inegalitarian, because not everyone can have access to positions of high rank. There are also hard limits to the amount of imaginary power that people can use against him, making it bounded, and giving him an upper hand. And because his power is imaginary, it has no physical signature and leaves no blood trail. This makes people less capable of detecting the threat of his power if it's used against them, making them less likely to be motivated to organize to countervail it. Table 3 provides a breakdown of these characteristics. Table 3. Characteristics of Chief Justice Dudley's imaginary or abstract power. System characteristics and descriptions. It is neither self-evident nor self-legitimizing. People can't instinctively recognize or respect his power based off its own merit, making it not independently verifiable. It's systemically endogenous. Because his power is internal to people's belief systems, it can be systemically exploited, thus making it a form of psychological abuse of a population through their belief system. It's sympathetic. He needs people to believe in or sympathize with his power, else it won't function. It also doesn't function the same for different people with different belief systems or sympathies. It's physically unconstrainable. In his operational domain of shared subjective abstract reality, there is no way to physically constrain him from using or scaling his power. People must attempt to use logical constraints to constrain him, but those are demonstrably insecure against systemic exploitation, and they also require people to believe in or sympathize with them. It's path-independent. The execution of his power can be reversed, appealed, or undone. It's thermodynamically unsound. This power can be created out of thin air and awarded to people. He doesn't have to be intelligent and resourceful to master nature to have more of it. He just has to change the rules. It's non-inclusive and inegalitarian. Not everyone can have access to the same type of power he has without specific rank, title, standing, or belief system. It's bounded. There are hard limits to the amount of his type of power that people can use against him. It's non-attributable. Because his power has no signature, in other words, no blood trail, it's very hard for people to see the threat of his power, much less organize to defend against it. It's non-energy intensive. Requires minimal effort to exercise his power, removing natural barriers to entry. It indirectly leads to injury. People indirectly get hurt when he exercises or mismanages his power, making it much harder for people to see and get upset by it, giving him far larger margin for error. Note how the socio-technical characteristics of imaginary power are mostly flaws. Because of these flaws, we can expect cooperation systems which use abstract power to settle intraspecies disputes, establish control authority over intraspecies resources, and achieve consensus on the legitimate state of ownership and chain of custody of intraspecies property to be dysfunctional and prone to systemic exploitation and abuse. Nevertheless, there are benefits to imaginary and abstract power. For starters, this kind of power requires minimal energy to exercise and has practically no natural barriers to entry, making it extremely efficient and easy to adopt. It is also less directly attributable to physical injury, making it ostensibly more moral. In other words, because imaginary power doesn't involve physical confrontation, it's ostensibly good. However, the reader should note that the underlying argument of this thesis is that abstract power is so dysfunctional that it directly motivates people to engage in large-scale physical confrontations, in other words, wars, effectively defeating its own purpose. Now that we have explicitly called out the socio-technical differences between real and imaginary power, and shown how these are physically, systemically, and ontologically different things, which should be expected to produce different, complex emergent behavior, we can take some time to reflect on why people so commonly misunderstand them. This requires an even deeper look at sapient psychology and metacognition. Section 4.5.5. Understanding the logical flaw of hypostatization. One of the most ubiquitous logical fallacies in modern agrarian society is the fallacy of ambiguity called hypostatization, where people construe a contextually subjective and complex abstraction, idea, or concept as a universal object. In plain terms, hypostatization is the mistake of believing something imaginary is something real. The fallacy of hypostatization is so common and ubiquitous in society that it's easy to forget it happens practically all the time. Similar to the saying about fish forgetting the presence of water, humans forget about the presence of hypostatization because they constantly think abstractly. Hypostatization is one of the most common logical fallacies, yet it's rarely discussed. Whole systems of philosophy, politics, religion, and social theories are built upon or supported by these fallacies. In his book, Science and the Modern World, Alfred Whitehead warns of a very similar fallacy of misplaced concreteness, where people build elaborate logical constructions of a high degree of abstraction, which causes them to regard abstract beliefs and hypothetical constructs as if they were concrete things. This is another fallacy of ambiguity called reification. Whitehead summarizes the reification fallacy as simply the accidental error of mistaking the abstract for the concrete. The distinction between hypostatization and reification comes down to the type of abstractions involved. Otherwise, their definitions are virtually identical. Reification is commonly understood as a subset of hypostatization, where the abstractions which are fallaciously regarded as concrete things are either theological, philosophical, or ideological. People who act like good and justice are concretely real things are guilty of reification because, technically speaking, good and justice are abstract concepts or beliefs which don't concretely exist in shared objective reality. Both hypostatization and reification are considered to be fallacies of ambiguity because they tend to happen when people get metaphors confused with literal meaning. Reification in literature,
where it is ostensibly understood to be intended metaphorically or as a figure of speech,
is encouraged and often considered to be good writing. So it becomes very common in writing for cultural reasons. However, when hypostatization or reification occurs in logical arguments, it becomes a logical fallacy. Thus, both are regarded as fallacies of ambiguity because it can be ambiguous whether the author intended to speak metaphorically or intended to make a sincere logical argument. This ambiguity is often deliberate, such as when it's used in rhetoric. Rhetoric relies heavily on reification and will often use literary metaphors to present logical arguments to make them more thought-provoking and attention-capturing.
Sapient neocortices crave their stories.
Understanding the fallacy of hypostatization and reification are key to understanding why people can enjoy control authority over resources without using physical power. They create an abstract form of power like rank, title, or station, and then through hypostatization, people mistake their abstract power for a real thing. Practically all belief systems used to manage resources depend on hypostatization or reification of abstract power, power which people think is concretely real, even though it technically exists nowhere except within their collective imaginations. This could be one reason why so few people talk about hypostatization despite its ubiquity. People in existing abstract power-based dominance hierarchies obviously wouldn't want their populations to think about how their abstract power isn't real.
Section 4.5.6. Legitimizing imaginary power using real power.
Force, my friends, is violence, the supreme authority from which all other authority is derived.
Gene Raschak, Starship Troopers.
Another way to motivate people to hypostatize abstract power,
other than by using persuasion or rhetoric,
is by using physical power to legitimize it. Rather than using theological, philosophical, and ideological arguments to convince people that one's abstract power is real, it's possible to create displays of physical power and then let your audience draw false positive correlations between two physically, systemically, and ontologically different things. To illustrate this point, consider the difference between kings and knights. We have established that a king's power is symbolic, not physically real. Yet sapiens have a clear tendency to cherish the symbolic world in their heads more than the physical one in front of their eyes. Being a modern human often means hypostatizing or reifying abstract constructs and then role-playing as if the abstractions are concretely real things. This behavior is why if you choose to disobey the king, you have a high probability of being injured by LARPers who actually wield real power, knights. Knights are people who have volunteered to subscribe to a belief system where kings have abstract power. Some of them may even believe that the king's abstract power is concretely real. Because people subscribe to these belief systems, they are willing to shape physically objective reality ex post facto to match what exists exclusively within their imagination. So, for example, storytelling kings will claim that disobedient people,
in other words, people who have not subscribed to the same belief system as them,
should be physically constrained or have their rank demoted to prisoner for being unsympathetic to the orders of the king. In response, knights will use their physical power to legitimize the king's abstract power by making shared objective physical reality match their shared subjective abstract reality. This process of using physical power to legitimize abstract power is more commonly known as enforcement. The name literally means to introduce force. In other words, the name means to inject real power into a situation where only imaginary power was previously being exercised. Enforcement is noteworthy because it shows the two aforementioned use cases of physical power projection occurring simultaneously. 1. Imposing physically prohibitive cost, and 2. Creating a proof of power, aka proof of real, signal. The knight's power is not only projected to increase the cost of attack and lower the BCRA of undermining an abstract belief system, but it's also projected to produce a proof of real signal to motivate people to draw false positive conclusions about the realness of the king's abstract power. In the first use case, physical power is projected to impose severe physical costs on people who don't subscribe to the same belief system and therefore aren't sympathetic to or influenced by the king's abstract power. As mentioned in the previous section, imaginary power is sympathetic. It needs people to believe in it or sympathize with it, or else it will not function properly. Therefore, not being sympathetic to the king's abstract power is a direct threat to the functionality of his entire abstract power hierarchy, and could expose that the king doesn't actually have real power. The solution is to impose real-world physical costs on those who are unsympathetic to the king's orders. This not only decreases the benefit-to-cost ratio of undermining the king's orders, but it also causes bystanders to hypostatize his imaginary power as something physically real. People are inclined to believe the king's imaginary power is real for the same reason they are inclined to believe a harmless stack of sticks is a deadly snake. Our brains produce false positive correlations between abstract thoughts, for example, the imaginary power of the king, and sensory inputs, for example, the physical power of the knights, because natural selection has caused our brains to take abstract imaginary things as seriously as physically real things. People are quick to hypostatize the king's imaginary power as real power because the knight's physical power projection manually generates a cross-referenceable physical sensory input to match the king's claim about having real power. In essence, enforcement leverages the same realness verification algorithm people use when they poke something or pinch themselves to generate haptic feedback. Knights manually generate force to displace mass over time to produce a proof of power signal of realness, the exact same way that people poke things or pinch themselves to produce a proof of power signal of realness. The main difference is that the proof of power signal comes from a third party, much like how actual haptic feedback systems work, and the amount of power used doesn't cause injury. An illustration of this is provided in Figure 47. False positive correlation produced by the brain's realness verification algorithm. As a quick side note, while the author was writing this, the founder of the Oculus virtual reality system claims to have designed a haptic feedback system for virtual reality gamers that physically harms or kills the wearer. The idea being that it makes the gaming experience feel more real and materially consequential. This is a perfect demonstration of the proof of power equals proof of real concept discussed here. A haptic feedback system which physically kills a gamer if they die in-game is, in essence, an enforcement system which works exactly the same as a knight who kills a citizen for disobeying the king. Both scenarios represent a situation where physical power is used to make something abstract feel more real, since the virtual reality of a video game is, by definition, just as abstract as a king's imaginary power. Since physical power is path-dependent and self-legitimizing, a virtual reality gaming system which utilizes physical power to kill its wearer if they die in-game inherits the systemic properties of the physical power it utilizes to make the game more path-dependent and legitimately hazardous. The physical power produced by a knight works exactly like a lethal haptic feedback system for virtual reality gaming systems. It provides a synchronous cross-referenceable signal of realness to match the king's abstract power. In other words, proof of power produces a proof of real signal. At the same time, the population contributes to the illusion. Other people subscribe to the same belief system that says the king's power is physically real, steering everyone's combined physical action to shape objective reality to match what is otherwise just an abstraction. As a result, the population is quick to lose sight of the fact that all abstract power held by all people of all ranks in all abstract power-based dominance hierarchies exist within the imagination only. None of it is physically real, no matter how many people LARP like it's real or use real-world physical power to make it look and feel more real. The combined effect is a population-scale consensual hallucination which can gaslight the public into believing in the divine strength of God kings. The result of enforcement is compliance with the king's orders. People who blatantly undermine the king's rank are physically punished for not recognizing his imaginary power by obeying his orders. This, combined with routine physical shows of power, makes people quick to commit the logical fallacy of believing the king's imaginary power is something concretely real. People will sincerely believe they are being physically compelled to behave some way merely by virtue of reading about it or watching physical power projectors march around on a computer screen, despite never having been involved in any physical confrontation. As another side note, this is why some regimes love military parades. These parades are marketed as a show of force to foreign nations and a way to comfort a proud population about how secure they are. But in actuality, a hidden purpose of the parade is for the regime to produce a proof of power signal for their own populations to motivate them to hypostasize the regime's abstract power as real power and make them less motivated to resist the regime. Section 4.5.7. Illegitimizing imaginary power using real power.
The world will know that free men stood against a tyrant, that few stood against many, and before this battle was over, that even a god king can bleed.
Leonidas, 300. U.S. President Kennedy was among the most abstractly powerful people to have ever lived when he was assassinated in 1963. Incidentally, Kennedy's assassination occurred just 5 months after signing Executive Order 11110,
which journalists have argued was an attempt to rein in the abstract power of the Federal Reserve. In his book, Crossfire, Jim Mars presents the argument that President Kennedy attempted to replace the purchasing power of Federal Reserve notes, in other words, money issued and controlled by the Federal Reserve, a private institution, with silver certificates, in other words, money issued and controlled by the U.S. Department of Treasury, a public institution with the deferred abstract power of the U.S. President. In other words, the logic encoded into Executive Order 11110 would have stripped the abstract power of the Federal Reserve to make money and give it back to the U.S. government. For that reason, journalists have argued that the Federal Reserve Bank, most notably the bank's anonymous shareholders who receive interest off their notes lent to the U.S. government, would have had the largest financial motive to contribute to President Kennedy's assassination, as Executive Order 11110 would have undermined their monopoly control of the U.S. monetary system. Of course, people can only speculate as to the true motive behind JFK's assassination, and there is no shortage of conspiracies related to the topic. But no matter what the true motive or motives were for JFK's assassination, it very clearly demonstrated how physical power is both superior to and unsympathetic to abstract power. President Kennedy had far higher rank and far more abstract power than the person who took his rank and abstract power away from him. But it didn't protect him because abstract power is merely imaginary power. Rank doesn't stop a speeding bullet. If, purely for the sake of illustrating a core concept of this grounded theory, we assume that people associated with the Federal Reserve Bank were indeed behind JFK's assassination because of financial motives, then JFK's assassination would represent a scenario that demonstrates how physical power both legitimizes and delegitimizes abstract power simultaneously. To fire a bullet is to project physical power kinetically for the purpose of imposing severe physical costs on neighboring organisms. In this scenario, the bullet which delegitimized the abstract power of the U.S. president would have simultaneously legitimized the abstract power of the Federal Reserve. Because 4 months after Kennedy's assassination, the redemption of silver certificates for silver dollars was irrevocably halted, implicitly restoring the Federal Reserve's monopoly control over the U.S. monetary system. As the demise of any leader at the top of any abstract power hierarchy has shown, of which there have been many examples, President Kennedy merely being the most recent one in our particular abstract power hierarchy, as easily as physical power can be used to legitimize abstract power, it can also be used to delegitimize abstract power. King Leonidas famously highlighted this concept in the movie 300 when he suggested that an effective way to undermine the legitimacy of God King Xerxes' hypostatized power is to make Xerxes bleed. This concept demonstrates yet another application of physical power. Physical power not only serves as a proof of real protocol, but it can also serve as a proof of not real protocol that illegitimizes people's claims to abstract power. This function alone explains why many wars are fought. In almost all cases of large-scale human versus human conflict, people try to either legitimize or delegitimize the abstract powers assigned to a given belief system. A technical name for this concept is power hypostatization, The act of believing that abstract power is concretely real power. The pitfall of power hypostatization is twofold. First, as illustrated in the previous subsection, the human tendency for power hypostatization motivates people to project physical power to convince a population to believe in their abstract power. Second, as illustrated in this subsection, power hypostatization simultaneously motivates people to project physical power to convince a population not to believe in someone's abstract power. In both cases, physical power is used to either legitimize or illegitimize abstract power, resulting in a kinetically destructive war. Power hypostatization is, of course, a glaring logical flaw. The flawed reasoning is easy to point out just by asking a few simple questions. For example, if the God King's power were concretely real, then why isn't it self-evident? Why does he need an army in the first place? Remove the knights, and there would be little confusion about the existence of the king's power. Without knights, it would be trivial to see that the king is, in fact, physically powerless. There would be no sensory input available to cross-reference the king's imaginary power with the knight's real power, thus no way for the mind to produce the false positive correlations that lead to power hypostatization. Any world where the people at the top of the abstract power hierarchies actually had the power people claim they have, there would be no such thing as assassinations or revolutions or foreign invasions. An all-powerful God-King wouldn't need to hire an army to fight a war for him. He would only need to snap his almighty finger. The fact that wars exist is therefore a direct byproduct of the fact that abstract power doesn't physically exist. The concept of force hypostatization highlights the metacognitive function of phenomena like enforcement and military shows of force. Metacognition, thinking about how humans think, helps us understand the primary value-delivered function of enforcement and military shows of force. These are both psychological techniques designed to influence people's behavior by getting them to either hypostatize abstract power as concretely real power, or to snap out of their consensual hallucinations and recognize that abstract power and real power are not the same kind of power. Thus, they don't have the same emergent behavior. As anyone who has ever experienced a military show of force maneuver can attest, for example, warning shots or low-altitude flybys of military aircraft, these are the moments where people wake up from their imaginary belief systems about power and realize that things just got real. A primary difference between what populations consider to be illegitimate and legitimate belief systems or legal policies, aka a generic set of rules versus the rule of law, is the amount of real-world physical power projected by people to enforce and secure those policies. The author could easily design a set of rules to encode his own abstract power-based dominance hierarchy and place himself at the top of it, but people are probably not going to subscribe to a belief system that the author is actually powerful, because the author lacks both the physical power and the storytelling capacity to convince people to believe his story. As an example of this concept, the abstract power encoded by the U.S. Constitution are backed by the U.S. military. When people of high rank try to undermine the U.S. Constitution, the U.S. military's job is to step in and remind them that the abstract power of the U.S. Constitution is backed by real power of the U.S. military and that real power is non-negotiable regardless of how unsympathetic people are to it. The most recent example where this happened was following the U.S. Capitol insurrection during the inauguration proceedings of President-elect Biden. In an unprecedented and thinly veiled warning by the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, the American public, to include the sitting commander-in-chief, were explicitly reminded that the armed forces of the United States remain fully committed to protecting and defending the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and that, in accordance with the Constitution, President-elect Biden will be inaugurated. Here, the Joint Chiefs explicitly reminded the public that their job is to physically secure the abstract powers encoded by the U.S. Constitution against foreign and domestic enemies. For example, against U.S. citizens and even the sitting commander-in-chief if necessary, if they were to continue to organize and illegitimize the U.S. constitutional process using physical confrontation. The phenomenon of power hypostatization is also why U.S. military service members do not have the same freedom of speech rights as civilians do, most notably the right to speak contemptuously towards public officials regardless of rank. In other words, people wielding physical power on behalf of the U.S. are not legally allowed to speak contemptuously towards people wielding abstract power on behalf of the U.S., because physical power illegitimizes abstract power and represents an existential threat to the existing abstract power hierarchy. Military service members are special in that they wield real power. It's one thing to have a politician speak contemptuously towards other politicians, as they often do, but it's an entirely different thing to have a commander of military forces speak contemptuously towards a politician. Almost every time this happens, the officer is quickly fired. A general has a lot more physical power backing up his rank than that of other civilian officers with similar rank. Because military forces are actually powerful, it would be inappropriate for military officers to speak contemptuously towards public officials, as that represents a direct threat to the abstract power of the existing abstract power hierarchy. To see the manifestation of this concept, watch any State of the Union address and take note of the Joint Chiefs. The reader will notice that the Joint Chiefs wear poker faces and scarcely react to any of the statements made by any commander-in-chief. This is to avoid non-verbally signaling approval or disapproval of anything spoken by their ranking officer during the public address. Now compare the Joint Chiefs' reactions to those in the audience who only wield abstract power, and the reader will notice a stark difference. Congressional members constantly signal their approval or disapproval of what is said during the public address, both verbally and non-verbally. History has shown us many times that people with close connections to standing armies wielding real power are a clear and present danger to high-ranking members of any abstract power hierarchy. Smooth-talking generals who speak contemptuously about their government's public officials have a well-documented tendency to eventually delegitimize their abstract power-based dominance hierarchies. All one has to do is read Cicero to get a play-by-play account of what it looks like when the imaginary power of senators operating in a republic gets usurped by smooth-talking generals calling themselves emperor. One way to mitigate this threat is to logically constrain the speech of military officers via laws, which prohibit them from speaking contemptuously towards public officials who wield abstract power. Making it illegal for military officers to speak contemptuously towards public officials serves as a stopgap or interlocking safety mechanism that gives high-ranking people the legal justification they need to fire or incarcerate an emerging threat before they have time to organize a military insurrection. This sometimes works to nip the threat of a coup d'etat in the bud before it blossoms, but it isn't always effective. Military insurrections can and do still happen, hence why the United States of America exists in the first place. Political assassinations and military insurrections showcase how real power trumps imaginary power whenever they come head to head. Many high-ranking people have relearned this lesson the hard way. A contributing factor to this problem appears to be that high-ranking people have a tendency to start believing in their own abstract power. They self-hypostatize their imaginary power as concretely real power. They make the critical mistake of believing the abstract powers granted to them by their rank is a concretely real thing, and they lose sight of the fact that they are physically powerless to do anything without other people who believe in their imaginary power and do the real power projection for them. As history testifies, the resource control authority afforded to abstract power hierarchies like monarchies only exist insofar as the ruled class, not the ruling class, is 1. Willing to believe in the monarchy's abstract power, and 2. Willing to back it with their own sweat and blood. Undermine the real power projectors, and the king's control authority over the population's valuable resources swiftly disappears, as it has for several monarchies throughout history. This is how new abstract power hierarchies like the US are born. Americans are first and foremost insurrectionists who used real power to delegitimize the abstract power of their oppressive king. The U.S. is proof of the concept that physical power trumps imaginary power. Section 4.5.8. Metcalfe's Law works both ways. Belief in abstract power can disappear as quickly as it appears. In addition to having their abstract power physically illegitimized, a king can also have their imaginary power suddenly vanish simply because of reverse network effects. In other words, a king can have their abstract power canceled if they become too abusive with it. The simple explanation for this is that Metcalfe's law works both ways. Just as the value of a belief system can grow non-linearly as the number of believers grows linearly, the value of a belief system can also fall non-linearly as its number of believers decreases. For this reason, it can be surprising how quickly the abstract power of a king or government can vanish from people's collective imagination once enough of the population realizes it is in their best interest to stop believing in it. Countless revolutions have shown very clearly that it takes far less time to dissolve an abstract belief system than it does to establish it. The same phenomenon manifests itself in the modern age as cancel culture. A king can lose the power he spent decades building just by saying or doing one wrong thing to have his power broadly questioned. For these reasons, rulers who seek to preserve their abstract power and control authority over resources would be wise not to forget about network effects or do anything to motivate mass defection. Rulers who prosper are rulers who understand they don't have real power. They just have abstract power, like rank, And there are major systemic differences between these two types of power. Section 4.6. Creating abstract power. The truth is, one who seeks to achieve freedom by petitioning those in power to give it to him has already failed, regardless of the response. To beg for the blessing of authority is to accept that the choice is the master's alone to make, which means that the person is already, by definition, a slave. Larkin Rose. Section 4.6.1. To wield abstract power over people, convince them they need your permission or approval. To seek permission or social approval from someone is to tacitly give them abstract power over you. On the flip side, if you want to create and wield abstract power over a large population of humans, simply convince them to adopt a belief system where they need permission or social approval from you. Once a population believes they need your permission or approval, you have successfully gained abstract power and influence over them. It should be noted that abstract power is a relatively new phenomenon. Evidence of abstract power appears quite recently in the human fossil record. An easy way to detect when humans started believing in abstract power is when they started giving some sapiens far more materially grandiose burial rituals than other sapiens. Pre-Neolithic society appears to have been largely rankless, with what anthropologist Peter Turkin describes as remarkably cooperative and egalitarian societies, with leaders who could not order their followers around, leading instead by example. For hundreds of thousands of years, humans lived in rankless societies like this, with very few distinctions beyond age, gender, and earned reputation. Everyone had a similar burial ritual. Then, starting in the Neolithic age after the invention of agriculture, disproportionately gaudy graves emerged, packed full of gold and other precious resources. God kings wielding enormous amounts of reified abstract power emerged. Not surprisingly, they exploited people with their imaginary power. As Turkin describes, they oppressed us, enslaved us, and sacrificed us on the altars of bloodthirsty gods. They filled their palaces with treasures and their harems with the most beautiful women in the land. They claimed to be living gods and forced us to worship them. Based on nothing more than artifacts dug up from the ground, we can observe that several thousand years ago, people suddenly learned that they could psychologically exploit their peers through their mutually adopted belief systems, and they've been doing it ever since. Somewhere along the path of sapient abstract thinking and cultural evolution, the practice of storytelling went from Paleolithic shamans describing the mysteries of the afterlife and imbuing the tribe with symbolic meaning, to god kings using rhetoric and written languages to convince thousands of people to mistake their imaginary forms of abstract power for something concretely real, then using that abstract power to gain and exploit control authority over the entire population's resources. The modern abstract power hierarchies we live in today are derived from a similar style of ideological gatekeeping, which god kings first mastered in early civilization. The general approach to creating and wielding abstract power appears to be largely the same as it started at least as early as 7,500 years ago. Creating abstract power can be described as a four-step process listed below and illustrated in Figure 48, a strategy for passive-aggressively creating and wielding abstract power. Step 1. Use storytelling skills to convince a population to adopt a belief system with a desired theological, philosophical, or ideological state of being. The existence of a desired state of being implicitly defines the existence of an undesired state of being, with a discrete separation between the two states of being.
In this example, this discrete separation is abstracted as a gate.
Step 2. Use storytelling skills to convince people there's a method, path, or gateway to reach the desired state of being. Step 3. Use storytelling skills to name yourself the gatekeeper who can generously lead people to and through the gate to achieve the desired state of being. This is a subversive form of abstract power building which distracts a population from seeing that you tacitly gave yourself denial of service power, which you can use to passive-aggressively deny and revoke people's access to the desired state of being. Step 4. Increase the adoption of your belief system. The first step of creating abstract power is to use one's storytelling and rhetoric skills,
applications of abstract thinking discussed in previous sections,
to construct a desirable theological, philosophical, or ideological state of being, then convince people it's a real thing via reification. For most of written history, this desired abstract state of being has been described as a place, a paradise of some kind, usually in the afterlife. As society becomes gradually less theological, the desired state of being has become gradually more ideological, but equally abstract. Instead of wanting to go to heaven, for example, people often want to be moral or ethical and will hypostatize or reify constructs like universal moral good as something concretely real. The desired state of being is often described as an all-or-nothing phenomenon rather than a spectrum. It's usually either zero or one. You're either in paradise or you're not. You're either moral or you aren't. It's important for the desired state to be discretely separable,
in other words, Boolean,
like this, because the creation of a discretely true state automatically implies the existence of a discretely false state. This way, the presence of a desired state,
for example, saved, divine, favored by the gods, moral or ethical,
tacitly implies the existence of an undesirable state.
For example, not saved, not divine, not favored by the gods, immoral or unethical,
as well as a discrete boundary between the two states which subtly and passive-aggressively denies unqualified people from reaching the desired state. If we recall the discussion on abiogenesis and passive-aggressive power projection tactics like pressurized membranes and colonization attacks in the previous chapter, this is essentially an abstract version of the same power projection tactic. Once people have adopted a belief system where there are two discretely separate states of being,
in other words, good and bad,
and we have convinced enough of the population to hypostatize or reify things like good and bad as concretely real things, the second step of creating and wielding abstract power is to imply there's a way to get from the undesired state,
for example, bad,
to the desired state,
for example, good.
The population must believe there's a gateway to good. Otherwise, it would be impossible to execute the third and probably most important step to creating abstract power. The third step to creating abstract power is to make oneself the Sherpa or gatekeeper, who is uniquely qualified to lead people from the undesirable state, for example, bad, to the desired state, for example, good. By becoming the Sherpa or gatekeeper, a person can wield abstract power passive-aggressively in the form of denial of service, DOS, attacks. Moral gatekeepers implicitly have the authority to deny people's access to the population's mutually desired state of being by simply saying someone doesn't qualify for it. In other words, the person nominated to be the moral judge has the ability to judge someone as immoral and outcast them. As an added bonus, this tacit and passive-aggressive abstract power projection tactic is easy for gatekeepers to disguise as benevolence, making it even more subversive and effective. People are quick to believe in desired states of being, for example, moral, ethical, good, or holy, due to the theological, philosophical, or ideological reasons, and quick to see their theological, philosophical, or ideological gatekeepers as people who generously lead others to desired theological, philosophical, or ideological paradise. The public becomes oblivious to the fact that moral gatekeepers are people who tacitly wield passive-aggressive power to socially outcast anyone they choose. The point is so important that it bears repeating. To seek permission or special approval from someone is to tacitly give them abstract power over you. As soon as a population nominates someone to be their gatekeeper, they become subservient to that gatekeeper.
As a side note, this could be one reason why a popular mantra within the Bitcoin community is to slay your heroes, because they instinctively recognize this passive-aggressive power projection tactic.
The fourth step to creating abstract power is straightforward. Convince as many people to adopt the belief system as possible. Because it's easy to disguise the gatekeeper's passive-aggressive, hypostatized and reified abstract power as benevolence, it's easy to motivate people to expand the reach of the gatekeeper's abstract power because they will believe they are helping their peers. Followers of any given belief system will be inclined to spread the good news that they have discovered the path to a theological, philosophical, or ideological paradise, and all people must do to get there is to do whatever the benevolent gatekeeper says to do. Pay no attention to the elephant in the room, the fact that we are handing a person the means to psychologically exploit and abuse the population. Section 4.6.2. Using moral ambiguity, politicking, and demagoguery to grow abstract power. As previously discussed, hypostatization and reification is often intended to be a figure of speech, but some people use it in rhetoric to convince people to reach fallacious conclusions through thinly veiled logical arguments. This commonly happens in politicking, when people use rhetoric to assert that something has theological, philosophical, or ideological qualities such as moral value, and then use moral value as the logical basis for their argument. This is problematic because morals are abstract constructs. They have no capacity to be causally efficacious, and they are ontologically independent from what we currently understand to be objective reality. Moreover, it's incontrovertibly recognized that hypostatization is a fallacy when used in logical arguments. The most insidious use of hypostatization or reification,
often employed by demagogues,
occurs when something intended to be taken as a logical argument is disguised as a series of moral or ethically charged metaphors. This could explain why people who seek to create abstract power often speak in metaphors. The true intent of these metaphors is to present a logical argument to persuade the audience to adopt a given belief system,
for which they're the gatekeeper who decides what right is.
But the logical argument is deliberately ambiguated as a story or series of metaphors to either 1. Disguise the order's unsound and fallacious logic, 2. Preemptively hedge against anticipated critical examination of the order's logic, 3. Make a more entertaining, motivating, or persuasive speech, or 4. Appeal to the desires and prejudices of ordinary people. To illustrate the ambiguous nature of rhetoric, consider President John F. Kennedy's famous inaugural address, written by Theodore Sorensen, perhaps most remembered for its "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country" statement. This chain of logic suggests American citizens exist for the sake of serving their government, which is directly contradictory to the philosophical intent of the American Constitution, and the founding fathers who proposed the exact opposite theory that governments should exist to serve the people. As previously discussed, Americans are insurrectionists, people who are overtly defiant to abstract power, dismissive of rank, disloyal to their king, capable of and highly motivated to kill thousands of redcoats to delegitimize their oppressive king's abstract power. The U.S. Constitution gives American citizens the right to free speech and the right to bear arms, for the explicit purpose of empowering American citizens to delegitimize the abstract power of their government if it becomes too abusive or systemically exploitative, just like the British monarchy did in the 1700s. Of course, President Kennedy was probably just being rhetorical to inspire the audience to understand the importance of civic action and public service. The point is that nobody can really know what his intentions were because of moral ambiguity. It's impossible to know whether the president was trying to inspire the audience to take civic action, or he was intentionally trying to present a blatantly un-American or non-constitutional argument and passive-aggressively imply that citizens are immoral unless they devote themselves to the service of their state. Moral ambiguity is still a relevant issue today. For example, patriotism is commonly used as a form of ideological gatekeeping for demagogues to create and wield abstract power. Section 4.6.3. Signs of people exploiting or abusing their abstract powers. I will send a fully armed battalion to remind you of my love. King George III. Hamilton, the musical. The principles of systems security apply to belief systems just as much as they apply to physical system security. It is important to be aware of one's own mental models and to guard against the threat of psychological exploitation and abuse of one's belief system. The reader is invited to reflect on signs of theological, philosophical, or ideological gatekeeping, intentional reification, politicking, moral ambiguity, demagoguery, or other examples of people trying to create abstract power so they can exploit it. There are clear signs of people trying to create and wield abstract power. People will claim that they know how to reach a paradise in the afterlife even though they can't see, smell, touch, taste, or hear it. People will claim there is an objectively moral or ethical good even though it can't be seen, smelled, touched, tasted, or heard. People will imply there are discrete differences between heaven and hell, moral and immoral, ethical and unethical. People will imply they get to decide what behavior qualifies as moral or immoral, ethical or unethical, or worthy of heaven or hell. Then, either directly or in some passive-aggressive way, storytellers will attempt to use their rhetoric to persuade you that you are guilty of being immoral or unethical, or you are destined to go to hell unless you behave the way they say you ought to behave, unless you follow some set of rules they say you have a moral obligation to follow, unless you adopt their belief system. Once you adopt these belief systems, you must understand that you have tacitly given them a form of passive-aggressive, abstract power over you. You have entered a permission-based belief system, where you tacitly need the permission and approval of the moral gatekeepers. This is a generalized approach that humans use to create and wield abstract power over other humans by exploiting them through their abstract belief systems. This is how most abstract power-based dominance hierarchies are formed. All abstract power hierarchies introduce a psychological attack vector in the form of systemic exploitation of people's belief systems. Does this mean all abstract power hierarchies are systemically exploitative? Not necessarily. But it does mean they can be systemically exploited. These types of belief systems rely on trusting in people with imaginary power. Whether or not abstract power hierarchies descend into a state of psychological exploitation and abuse depends upon the population's ability to recognize the signs of it happening. Unlike the abuse of physical power, the abuse of abstract power can scale far higher, far faster, and be far harder to recognize because it doesn't leave a blood trail. Section 4.7. Abstract Power Hierarchies. What good is a title if you have to earn it? Sir Walter Elliot, Persuasion. Section 4.7.1. Nothing but stories told by storytellers. We have established that sapiens are unique in comparison to other species in nature because of how much they rely on abstract sources of power to form their dominance hierarchies, rather than physical power to form their dominance hierarchies. Sapiens have been behaving this way since at least the dawn of the Neolithic era. If the previously mentioned anthropological theories are true, then using abstract power to form dominance hierarchies became popular because they gave people a way to avoid physical confrontation while simultaneously helping them to emotionally reconcile the cognitive dissonance they were feeling about their domestication of animals and mass destruction of surrounding flora and fauna. It is clear from the fossil record that humans started believing in abstract power and using it to form their dominance hierarchies thousands of years before the invention of written language. Thus, thousands of years before sapiens were even capable of formally encoding the logic of their abstract power hierarchies using what we now call rules of law. Written language is what gave sapiens the means to begin formally codifying the logic of their abstract beliefs using syntactically and semantically complex logic. As previously mentioned, one of the major benefits of storytelling is that it allows people to transcend their physical constraints and cooperate on much larger scales. Written language was a storytelling game changer when it comes to getting people to adopt common belief systems about abstract power, because written languages transcend the need for synchronous communications of stories. Write something down, and that story can be shared asynchronously with unlimited people without the author needing to be present, or even alive. People with abstract power took advantage of written language to convince more people to believe in their abstract power. This means written language was yet another power projection tactic. To this day, written language still remains one of the most potent power projection tactics in human society,
hence why the pen is often considered to be mightier than the sword.
Not surprisingly, the ability to read and write increased the likelihood of having abstract power and control authority over other people's valuable resources. Literacy, especially the ability to read and write laws,
or in modern times, the ability to read and write software,
translates directly to abstract power. Practically as soon as people learned how to write, they started encoding logic into rules of law, which placed themselves at the top of an abstract power hierarchy. Alternatively, if their attempts to give themselves abstract power were too obvious, people would use their reading and writing skills to place a god at the top of the abstract power hierarchy, and subversively imply they were God's formally chosen representative, implicitly giving themselves access to God's abstract power. There are several different ways to create and award oneself with abstract power, but the bottom line is that the people who write the stories and make the laws had a clear tendency to become the rulers. Literacy therefore translates directly into the ability to build empires and exploit populations through their belief systems at unprecedented scale. We have established that abstract power and abstract power hierarchies are nothing but belief systems. They are elaborate logical constructions with high degrees of abstraction passed down over thousands of generations of storytelling. Symbols of this abstract power can be pressed into clay, written on parchment, worn as a crown, or encoded into a computer. But the abstract power they wield exists nowhere except within the minds of sapiens, the only place where it isn't both physically powerless and objectively meaningless. Because people mistakenly hypostatize abstract power as real power, people tend to forget this. As more people treat abstract power as a concretely real thing, they proceed to act as if it is a concretely real thing, and that combined action convinces others it's a concretely real thing. Eventually, everyone just starts acting like abstract power is a real thing without questioning it. Creating abstract power is therefore a fake it till you make it phenomenon. People can fake like they have real power until people start acting like they have real power, and eventually project real power for them, creating a self-perpetuating cycle. Early god kings were similar to celebrity influencers, and the written languages they used to create and expand their abstract power was a way to make their influence go viral faster. This is a very important concept to note, because in the next chapter, the author will describe how this is exactly what's happening following the invention of a new language called machine code, and a new form of literacy that gives people control over people's computers and digital information. The bottom line up front is that software represents a new way for people to encode abstract power hierarchies, which place themselves at the top of those abstract power hierarchies. The argument will be made that computer programs give 21st century humans the ability to create and wield abstract power at unprecedented scale. But before we get there, we need to develop a thorough understanding about the abstract power hierarchies formed in previous centuries. Section 4.7.2 Types of Abstract Power Hierarchies. Societies appeared in Mesopotamia at least as early as 6,000 years ago, and evolved into, ostensibly, the first cities and states around 5,000 years ago. With the invention of written language during the same time frame, these abstract power hierarchies were formally codified into written rule sets we now call rules of law, marking the beginning of written history. Not surprisingly, the design philosophy of these abstract power hierarchies was rooted in theology, philosophy, and ideology. They rely on having someone declare the right way to settle disputes, establish control authority over property, and achieve consensus on the legitimate state of ownership and chain of custody of property. The people with the highest rank at the top of these abstract power hierarchies are ostensibly the best qualified people to know what right is. To use the terminology from the previous section, the highest ranking members within these abstract power hierarchies are the moral gatekeepers from whom the population seeks permission and approval. Over time, the abstract power wielded by high-ranking people within their abstract power hierarchies got hypostatized. Their imaginary power began to look and feel physically real because everyone started thinking and acting as if it were real. This still holds true today. Theological, philosophical, and ideological gatekeepers start to look powerful because our peers start thinking and acting like they're powerful. Fast forward through thousands of years of storytelling, and this process has produced many types of abstract power hierarchies involving many different types of high-ranking people who wield many types of abstract power. Regardless of their structure, all abstract power hierarchies effectively work the same way. The people at the bottom of the dominance hierarchy must have permission and approval from the people at the top of the dominance hierarchy. In other words, all abstract power hierarchies are trust-based, permission-based, and inegalitarian systems. The people at the top of these hierarchies are the people who are supposedly the most qualified to determine what permissions and approvals the rest of the population ought to have. This means all abstract power hierarchies are simultaneously trust-based systems. The people at the bottom of the dominance hierarchy must trust that the people at the top are indeed the most qualified to determine what permissions the population ought to have. The people at the bottom of the dominance hierarchy must also trust that the people at the top won't deliberately withhold their permission and approval, nor systemically exploit the population with their special permission and approval capabilities. Therein lies the massive systemic security flaw of all abstract power hierarchies. The first types of people from which populations sought permission and approval appear to be Paleolithic shamans. These shamans were eventually replaced by Neolithic priests and god-kings. By the Bronze and Iron Ages, cultural evolution,
and a whole lot of physical conflict,
changed god kings into regular kings, senators, or emperors. Today, the highest ranking positions wielding the most amount of abstract power are called kings, presidents, senators, and prime ministers. These high-ranking positions sit within the encoded abstract power hierarchies described in Table 4. Table 4. Examples of modern-day abstract power hierarchies. Abstract power hierarchy designs, how the abstract power is encoded into the design, and examples. The Presidential Republic. The head of state is a president that serves as the head of government, exercises abstract power alongside an independent legislature. Examples: the United States of America, Mexico, and most countries in South America. The Semi-Presidential Republic. The head of state is a president who has some executive powers and exercises abstract power alongside an independent legislature. Remaining abstract power of the president is invested in a ministry that is subject to parliamentary confidence. Examples: France, Russia, Ukraine, Mongolia, and South Korea. The republic with executive presidency nominated or elected by a legislature. The president is both head of state and government. The ministry,
including the president,
may or may not be subject to parliamentary confidence. Examples: South Africa, Botswana, and Guyana. The Parliamentary Republic. The head of state is a president who is mostly or entirely ceremonial. The ministry is subject to parliamentary confidence. Examples: Germany, Italy, and India. The constitutional monarchy. The head of state is a monarch that is mostly or entirely ceremonial. The ministry is subject to parliamentary confidence. Examples: the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, Spain, Norway, and Sweden. The semi-constitutional monarchy. The head of state is an executive monarch who personally exercises abstract power in concert with other institutions. Examples: Morocco, Jordan, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. The absolute monarchy. The head of state is executive, with all authority invested in a monarch. Examples: the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and Oman. The one-party state. The head of state is executive or ceremonial, and abstract power is constitutionally linked to a single political movement. Examples: China, North Korea, and Vietnam. Something important to note about today's abstract power hierarchies is that they're exponentially more centralized and asymmetrically powerful now than they have ever been in the history of human civilization. The valuable resources of approximately 8 billion people are now controlled by something like 10,000 high-ranking people across the world, who have the overwhelming majority of all abstract power. While highly energy efficient, this type of social system comes at the cost of creating systemic security vulnerabilities. Never in human history have so many valuable resources been more centrally controlled by such a small ruling class.
It would have been mathematically impossible in the past due to population sizes, even though there were a large number of independent city-states.
People are living in an abstract belief system where the combined global resources of all sapiens are governed by only 0.0001% of its population. Section 4.7.3. Modeling the differences between physical power-based and abstract power-based resource control. The abstract power-based dominance hierarchies created by behaviorally modern sapiens can be modeled as resource control structures. Abstract power-based resource control structures that sapiens use have the same function as the physical power-based resource control structures of other species modeled in the previous chapter. This means we can compare the abstract power-based resource control system created by Neolithic sapiens to the physical power-based resource control system created by natural selection to gain some additional insight about how and why human attempts to establish their dominance hierarchy using something other than physical power can result in different complex emergent behavior. Figure 49 and Figure 50 compare both resource control systems. See Section 3.11 for a more thorough explanation of Figure 49. At first glance, physical power-based and abstract power-based resource control structures look the same. The controlled process is the same, and so is the purpose of the overall control structure: to establish consensus on the state of ownership and chain of custody of resources. The controllers are also the same. Just as wild pack animals are comprised of members and physical power projectors, post-Paleolithic society is also comprised of members and abstract power projectors. Similarly, just as physical power functions as a controller with control authority over members and power projectors, so too does abstract power function as a controller and wield control authority over sapiens. Consequently, both resource control techniques have the same overall shape and structure. A clear difference between the systems is the type of power used. Whereas wild animals use physical power, watts, to establish control authority over resources, post-Paleolithic sapiens attempt to use imaginary or abstract power, rank, to establish control authority over resources. Sapiens use their large neocortices to create an imaginary source of power within their collective minds called rank, and then they nominate different people to have that rank. These high-ranking abstract power projectors are formally granted control authority over society's resources via formally codified rules of law, allowing them to approve or deny people's access to society's resources, as well as change the state of ownership of those resources. For example, the state of ownership of dry land is usually controlled by government executives or ministries. Civilians, in other words, members, within modern society must request access to that land, and government officials approve or deny those requests. Major differences between physical and abstract power-based resource control systems have been enumerated and highlighted in different colors. Beginning with the control actions highlighted in purple, the first of four enumerated control actions worth noting for its differences is the subscribe control action executed by members and power projectors. Members and power projectors within abstract power-based systems subscribe to the control authority of abstract power, just like they do within physical power-based systems. What makes this control action appreciably different is the fact that it's implicitly voluntary. Whereas members and power projectors of physical power-based systems do not have the ability to unsubscribe from the control authority of Watts, members and power projectors of abstract power-based systems do have the ability to unsubscribe from the control authority of rank. People can simply choose to be unsympathetic to rank by ignoring it or refusing to believe in it, whereas it is physically impossible to ignore or be uninfluenced by real-world physical power. The second of four enumerated control actions worth noting for its systemic differences is the request and ranking control action executed by power projectors. Whereas physical power projectors receive their physical power passively via natural sortition and actively via engineering ingenuity, abstract power projectors receive their rank passively via things like rhetoric, enforcement, and rules of law. They run for election, or they climb their way up an existing hierarchy to achieve the rank they desire. People don't achieve their rank unless it's passed on to them, hence the practice of bloodlines and inbreeding, or randomly, unless sortition is codified into the rule of law. Romans used to do this to mitigate the threat of corrupt people abusing their rank, and the US does this using concepts like jury duty. The third of four enumerated control actions worth noting is the enrank control action executed by power projectors. Instead of being physically empowered, power projectors within abstract power-based resource control systems are merely enranked. As discussed previously, abstract power projectors don't have real, in other words, physical, power. The last of four enumerated control actions worth noting is the change abstract state control action executed by abstract power projectors. Because abstract power projectors don't have physically real power, they cannot physically change the state of ownership and chain of custody of resources in shared objective physical reality. They can only change the abstract state of ownership of resources. In other words, high-ranking people can claim that a piece of property you physically control access to doesn't belong to you, but they can't physically gain access to or physically deprive you from having access to it. Thus, the ability of abstract power projectors to change the state of ownership and chain of custody of agrarian resources is symbolic only. They are actually physically powerless to do this. Another noteworthy difference between physical versus abstract power projectors is that abstract power projectors can't execute the same control actions as physical power projectors can. Whereas physical power projectors can physically gain access to resources and physically defend access to resources, abstract power projectors can do neither of these things. The same flaw of imaginary power keeps appearing in different ways. High-ranking people are physically powerless.
Section 4.7.4. Physical power hierarchies are inclusive, but abstract power hierarchies aren't. The different characteristics of physical power, watts, and abstract power, rank, lead to several different complex emergent properties between physical power-based and abstract power-based dominance hierarchies and resource control structures. There are at least three major differences worth noting for this theory. The first of the three major differences between physical power-based dominance hierarchies and abstract power-based dominance hierarchies is that physical power hierarchies are inclusive to everyone, whereas abstract power hierarchies aren't. Everyone has access to watts and can effectively vote with them. Everyone can swing a fist, swing a blade, pull a trigger, solve a hash function, or do a host of other things to use physical power to represent their interests. This makes physical power hierarchies highly representative of the will of the people who choose to use it. In contrast, abstract power is non-inclusive. Few people get to have rank,
and not everyone gets the right to vote. Instead, only an extremely small sample of the population gets to have rank required to vote on the rules, making the system far less representative of the will of the people who choose to use rank rather than watts. In this sense, terms like representative democracy are oxymorons akin to terms like the People's Republic, because a very small number of votes,
0.0001% in the case of the U.S. representative democracy,
is, statistically speaking, not a highly representative sample size of the population's beliefs and interests. Section 4.7.5. Physical power hierarchies give everyone unbounded power, but abstract power hierarchies don't. A second major systemic difference between physical power,
watts,
and abstract power,
rank,
hierarchies, is that watts are unbounded and non-zero sum, whereas rank is bounded and zero sum. There is no theoretical limit to the amount of physical power honest people can use to represent and secure their interests. This systemic difference is especially relevant in voting systems because it makes voting systems simple to systemically exploit. For example, the resources and interests of 330 million Americans is controlled by less than 1,000 high-ranking people. This means Americans are limited to the abstract power of less than 1,000 people to represent and secure their interests. If the majority of those 1,000 high-ranking people collude at the expense of the people they ostensibly represent, then 330 million people are mathematically guaranteed not to be able to overturn their vote. They can't access more rank, and they can't outvote or overturn collusion, resulting in a state of systemic oppression which can only be solved via physical confrontation.
Hence why republics and democracies descend into civil wars and revolutions.
This security vulnerability occurs because all abstract power hierarchies and voting systems are trust-based and permission-based systems. People must necessarily trust that their representatives will use their rank to represent public interests rather than their own personal interests, because they are physically powerless to stop them, as well as mathematically incapable of countervailing a regulatorily captured voting system. People must operate based on the tacit permission of a small number of high-ranking people who control the majority vote, because otherwise, people are both mathematically and physically incapable of adding more votes to impeach the colluding members' codified control authority. If there is no way to impeach the control authority of majority or unanimous voters, then it's technically a trust-based and permission-based system where a centralized ruling party has irrevocable control authority. Cicero famously called this design feature out: "Great is the power, great is the authority of a Senate that is unanimous in its opinions." Section 4.7.6. Physical power hierarchies can't be systemically exploited, but abstract power hierarchies can. A third major systemic difference between physical power,
aka watts,
hierarchies, and abstract power,
aka rank,
hierarchies, is that watts are exogenous to people's belief systems and therefore invulnerable to systemic exploitation, whereas abstract power is endogenous to people's belief systems and therefore vulnerable to systemic exploitation. In other words, rank exists internally within the system it's used. The control authority associated with rank is formally codified by rulemakers, and so are the logical constraints. That means lawmakers can simply change the rules or write exploitable logic to gain, maintain, and abuse their abstract power. Rulemakers can meddle with the rules, bait and switch the rules, or deliberately design their logic to have exploitable properties, which benefit one group of people at the expense of others. Rulemakers can design the rules to award themselves with more voting power than other people, or they can make one side's rank and votes carry more mathematical weight and control authority than another side's rank and votes by simply changing the logic of the voting system. With discrete mathematical precision, rulemakers can design loopholes, backdoors, trapdoors, and zero days into the system's design logic, which nullify people's ability to represent and secure themselves. They can award themselves with veto power. They can exploit their voting protocols via gerrymandering or counterfeiting or other common forms of fraud. There are many ways abstract power can be systemically exploited, and there are many ways to deliberately design rules of law so that they are intentionally exploitable without detection from the public. Physical power, on the other hand, is impossible to systemically exploit in this manner because nobody has the capacity to write any of the rules. Watts are systemically exogenous and fully independent from anyone's belief system, or any rule set designed or encoded by any person for that matter. Physical power exists in an ontologically separate plane of knowledge than abstract power, predating human-made constructs like rank and authority by at least 14 billion years. It's impossible to counterfeit Watts. It's impossible to meddle with the properties of Watts or bait and switch Watts. It's impossible to gerrymander Watts. There is no way to veto someone's Watts or make one person's Watts carry more weight than another person's Watts. There is no way to ignore someone's Watts. Nobody with any amount of rank can escape from the effects of Watts. Being unsympathetic to Watts doesn't negate the effect of Watts. There's no way to manipulate the logic of Watts to subversively encode exploitable backdoors or trapdoors. Watts are free from the risk of meddling, interference, mismanagement, and abuse. For these and many more reasons, Watts produce a systemically secure technique for people to represent their will, resolve their disputes, and reach consensus on the legitimate state of ownership and chain of custody of their resources.